Hi, everyone. So about a month ago, I bought a bike, primarily for commuting once we go back to the office, but also for just getting out there. It's a gravel bike, built to be great on pavement, but if you see a trail off to the side, you'll be fine. I love it. I really do. But at the same time, I also bought a car. Am I happy about it? No, not really. It's my first car in 7 years since moving here to London from Washington, D.C. When I sold my last car back in 2013, I said, okay, the next one will definitely be fully electric. But it didn't happen. We went fully ICE, or internal combustion engine. The main reasons, and I'm talking as a consumer here, were charging and choice. With charging, well, there are places to charge. You see them around, but not at my flat. We only have street parking and no charge points nearby. And choice, I'm not in the market for a Tesla. And when I was looking around, the fully electric cars seemed a bit fewer and further between. Maybe both these were a matter of perception and I should have done more research, but also maybe I'm a good proxy for the public who needs it to be a bit easier. Okay. But despite the ICE, it doesn't make me any less of a fan of EVs and doesn't make me want one any less. Next car will absolutely be electric. And I told myself by the time I'm in the market again, the charging infrastructure and range of models will have caught up. Well, if today's guest has anything to do with it, that will absolutely be the case. Today, we're joined by UK Member of Parliament and Parliamentary Undersecretary of State at the Department for Transport, Minister for the Future of Transport and Decarbonisation, Rachel McLean. You'll note that the very first thing Minister McLean says is that for the UK to hit the 2050 net zero emissions target they set, they need to expand the charging network and offer enough EVs at the right price. But during the conversation, she and my co-host and head of Europe, Middle East, and Africa for BNF, Dana Perkins, look at the future of transport in the UK as a whole. They discuss hydrogen, trains, planes, emission standards, bikes, scooters, and how each can contribute to the 2050 net zero target. Dana's interview with Minister McLean took place as part of the BNF London Summit on October 20th. BNF users can see this interview and more, including all the BNF analyst talks on BNF.com, the BNF mobile app, and the Bloomberg Terminal. As a reminder, BNF does not provide investment or strategy advice, and you can hear the full disclaimer at the end of the show. I'm Mark Taylor, and you're listening to Switched On. Now over to Dana for her interview with Minister McLean.
Minister McLean, thank you so much for joining us today and taking time out of your busy schedule.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Dana. Thank you for having me along.
So let's dive right in. Let's talk about net zero emissions and the electric vehicle transition. So here we are. We're in the UK. We have a 2050 target, and no doubt electric vehicles are going to play an important part in that. So if we're looking at the transition that needs to take place over the next 10 to maybe 15 years, I want to know what are the most significant steps you think need to be taken in order to achieve that goal in that timeline?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a very ambitious goal, but we are really confident that we can meet it. And what's more, we are committed as a government. We think it's vitally important. And we are the first major economy to actually legislate for that net zero target. So we do have a lot of work to do. And I think as anyone who drives an EV knows, whether you know you're doing it for sort of commercial reasons or you're just a private driver, you will know that one of the key challenges is around the infrastructure side of things, getting that charging infrastructure in the right place, at the right cost, getting it there reliably for people. And that's vital that we get that right. And I think the second thing is making sure that we have enough electric vehicles available to buy at the right price for people. So you will know that the government is already supporting the purchase price of electric vehicles, cars for private individuals, private buyers and drivers, and also providing a lot of support for business customers as well through plug-in car grants and so on, and helping people to get charge points installed at their homes or their workplaces. But that work clearly has to continue and it has to accelerate. And that is exactly what we are committed to doing.
What do you think will be the most important mechanism in order to get, as you were discussing on prices, what do you think will be the most important thing to make them accessible to people at a wide range of incomes, given that they are currently, at least right now, more expensive than internal combustion engines?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things to consider about the price of an electric vehicle. There are new models coming into the market all the time. And what we know about the automotive industry is it's fantastic at innovating. So certainly, as we start to see the direction of travel through legislation and also through consumer demand, we know that the car industry will respond to that. We absolutely accept it's a hard time for the car industry at the moment. But even just recently, we saw electric vehicle registrations accelerate and really quite significantly. So the number of people that are choosing to buy an electric vehicle now as a percentage of all car buyers is bigger than it has ever been since we started keeping these records. So we have to consider the overall cost of an electric vehicle. And of course, if you are not filling it up at the pump, you're saving a huge amount of money. You're keeping cash in your pocket that you would have been, you know, putting into your petrol or diesel tank. So we are providing a lot of support for people with that initial purchase price. And that is in place at the moment for the foreseeable future. But we will have to keep that under review as we consider, you know, where do we invest government cash in this infrastructure transition and this revolution towards electric driving.
So you were saying a record number of electric vehicles are being purchased. Do you think it is that cost savings at the pump that's driving it? Or what do you think is the primary reason people are buying them?
Well, I genuinely think that is a real mindset shift with people. And we saw it before COVID, but I think COVID has brought it to the fore. And we've seen people really think about the fact that they did really like the fact that their air was clean, that their streets were clean during the lockdown period. It made them appreciate, if you like, the health of our planet, how everything is connected. And it made them consider the choices that they're making in all areas of their lives. And so we as a government, we really welcome that. And we are committed to a green recovery across all of the work that we're doing. So now is a real moment, I think, for people who are coming into the market, looking at what's available, and thinking about doing that for the sort of the right reasons, if you like, thinking about the environmental reasons, as well of course, of that cost factor. So taking into account the overall cost of ownership of an electric vehicle, it can work out significantly cheaper over the long term.
So let's talk a little bit about the emission standards and kind of the role the government has to play in looking at some of this. In the EU, you know, they have some pretty aggressive emission standards coming out. With the UK, do you think that the policies here are going to make the electric vehicle transition faster or slower, or, you know, are they going to be stricter? Are they going to be more lax? And how will that come into play as we leave the European Union?
So obviously, as we're leaving the European Union, all the regulations that were part of the EU law book will be brought into our law. So we will have those standards domestically as the EU did, but we are currently consulting on what will our standards look like after the end of the transition period. And we will see the results of that consultation very soon. But we've been very clear that we're going to be at least as ambitious as the EU in our emission standards, because we want to be leading in this area. And we see the opportunity of leaving the EU as a chance for us to set our own standards that's right for our own market, right for our own environment.
So that's great. And you actually also pointed out a little bit earlier that the automakers have tremendous amount of innovation when they put their mind to it. So what will you think it will be the best way in order to incentivize the automakers to be a part of the emissions reduction strategy?
Well, I have regular conversations with all the automakers, and I can tell you that they are absolutely up for the challenge. And they definitely have already got very advanced plans, almost all of them, to go to a sort of zero carbon or a very low carbon product range. But it is important that we as government support them in this. It's a vital industry employing thousands of people up and down the UK with highly skilled jobs, you know, lots of different areas of the country. So we have made available £1.5 billion already to help them make that transition to new forms of technology. And we know we need to continue to work hand in hand with the industry on issues like batteries, supply of batteries, how our batteries recycle, to help them develop that technology that they will need to grasp this new opportunity. But it's a very constructive relationship that we have with them.
So in terms of technology advancements, one that is looking very promising at the moment and actually switching tracks a little bit is onto hydrogen, in particular for the hard to abate sectors. So what are some of the more promising things that you think are happening over at the Department of Transportation when it comes to hydrogen? And then additionally, like, what are some of the benchmarks that you're looking for in areas, let's say, aviation, that show us that we're succeeding? You know, what things are you looking for? And I think therefore we should be looking for.
So we definitely see a future in hydrogen. Across the department, we maintain a technology neutral approach. So we don't necessarily pick or choose one particular technology, but we definitely think hydrogen's got a very significant role to play, as you mentioned, in some of those harder to decarbonize sectors, specifically the heavier sectors, such as maritime, such as the freight sector, and potentially aviation as well. We've already seen a hydrogen-fueled plane take off just last week, and there's also potentially in trains as well. And I think it's really exciting to see the development of the hydrogen policy now. Last week, I was lucky enough to go to Middlesbrough to actually open the first hydrogen for transport hub. And what we're doing with that is we are looking to see how transport can actually work on the ground in a specific location. So we can consider all the different parts of the hydrogen ecosystem, for example, the fueling, where does the power come from, how do we get the hydrogen, how do we actually make it work at scale in a location with buses and lorries and ships and all the different modes of transport. So there's a lot more work to do as we develop that technology even further, because at the moment it does need to sort of overcome some hurdles in terms of that mass commercialization, particularly with the green hydrogen. And that's where we want to go with it. So it's an exciting time for it, and we are investing heavily in the R&D for hydrogen.
There are some physical limitations to hydrogen. Do you think that there is a specific part of the UK that's going to benefit most from this incubation, or is it too early to tell?
Well, it is a bit early to tell. We picked Middlesbrough Teesside for our first transport hub out of a number of places, actually, because it does have all the right capacity for our initial work. It's got a port, it's got access to renewable energy, it's got a very highly developed skills base, and also it's got a fantastic university there with the cutting edge R&D research. So it had all the factors there, but there's no reason why other areas of the UK couldn't also benefit. There's some great work going on in Scotland, for example, and in fact across the UK. So we want to see it spread out across all areas that could benefit in the future.
Well, so let's talk about COVID. It's definitely on the top of everyone's minds. And I think I can say that it's changed everybody's lives in a lot of different ways. And one of those that I think we're just at the beginning of seeing is maybe a move of people out of cities, and maybe having eventually longer commutes, but less frequently. And we know right now that those commutes actually need to be much less densely packed. So that changes everything for the rail network in terms of how they make their money. And my question is really around, do you think that there will need to be ongoing government intervention in the rail networks in order to keep these, you know, commuter trains running?
Well, I think you're right to point to a huge shift in society and in the way that we work. And I don't think that's fully played out yet. But certainly the government has recognised that we do need to underwrite the rail network, certainly at the moment. And that's why, you know, you've seen that process take place. We've kept the trains running, even though there's very little revenue coming in from them. I have noticed myself, because I've had to carry on commuting basically through most of the lockdown, because we were sort of called back to Westminster, as you probably know. So I've had to travel by train from my constituency, and it was very, very quiet at the beginning, but the numbers are starting to pick up now. And so the message that we are sort of putting out there as a Department of Transport is it is safe to travel. The train operating companies have done a fantastic job actually cleaning those trains, making them safe, making sure everybody can feel comfortable to travel and wearing face masks. So it's a bit too early to see how it's going to play out, but at the for the time being, it is safe to travel, and it's a much greener way of traveling than getting in a car.
Okay, so let's say you're not taking the train and you live close enough to do those short trips. And I am seeing bike lanes open up all over London, actually, at the moment. And I am now a proud bike owner, and I'm going to be doing my commute via bike. So in this micro mobility space, you know, actually, another thing that has become popular have been these electric scooters, which are currently not yet legal. What do you foresee happening with those? Is there a path to legalization? And also, how big of an impact do you think micromobility can have? So bikes and electric little scooters on the overall emissions reduction strategy.
Well done you getting on your bike. I actually bought an e-bike as well at the weekend, and it's fantastic. It's very hilly where I live, so it's been a bit of a revelation. But e-scooters are really quite a very, very new and potentially very exciting policy area, actually. And I think what we took the view that, well, look, you know, these are available in pretty much every other European country that you go to. And we know that there is a demand for them. We know that people are using them illegally, as you say. You know, it very clear, it is illegal to ride them at the moment unless you're in a trial area. But in recognition of the fact that we are in a global pandemic, we're in an extraordinary situation where there were issues with getting on public transport, But at the same time, we wanted to maintain our commitment to greener forms of transport. That's why we brought forward the trials of e-scooters, which are now taking place in a few areas, not in London yet, but they're taking place in about half a dozen areas of the UK, and we'll have a few more coming on stream as well. And I think there is a huge potential in e-scooters. They don't replace cycles or walking. They are an alternative for people who may choose to use them on a certain day for a certain journey where it may not be appropriate or may not be their preference to use a bike. But it's certainly a very good alternative if you were going to make a very short journey by a car to use an e-scooter instead. And that's how we see it playing into the mix, because we know that vast numbers of car journeys are very short. They're 3 or 4, maybe even 5 miles. And it's entirely foreseeable that someone would use an e-scooter for that type of journey. And you imagine the potential reduction in carbon and greenhouse gas that's going to be achieved if we can shift even a few of those car journeys onto e-scooters, or indeed on other forms of micromobility vehicles. We are looking across the board, actually, at where we could potentially introduce other forms of slightly new vehicles that are out there. I mean, I'm all in favour of innovation, and some of these things can help people get around, people with mobility issues that, you know, maybe can't cycle or walk. So I think it's right that we free up this sort of innovation, as long as we're doing it safely, which we are.
What are some other examples of things that you guys are looking at? So we've got the electric scooters and the bikes and electric bikes. What are some other things on the kind of cutting edge tech-wise?
There's a lot of sort of work in progress going on. We obviously are a leader in this country in sort of automation, self-driving vehicles as well. So that's work is coming on stream. There's quite a lot of vehicles in the sort of what we call the novel vehicle category. So as well as the scooters that you've seen, there are seated scooters that are very beneficial for some people. There's smaller vehicles that don't really, it's a broad class of vehicles called L-class vehicles. And there's some things in there that are really quite cool and look quite futuristic. So we're examining how we can enable some of these new vehicles to come to the market and be safely adopted onto our roads across the UK.
Okay, so hopefully they make a difference in those short haul, last miles traveled. Mm. Well, so yeah, let's go back to emissions and some of the other ways that the Department of Transportation might be thinking of incubating new ideas. I think we know where we need to get to, but it's not entirely clear how we're going to get there, and we're going to need to run some experiments and take some chances. What are some areas where you think we maybe aren't even yet, but could be collecting data and taking a few more experiments to really push innovation?
We recognize that we do have, you know, a lot to work through in order to reach this target. What we've been doing is working across the whole Department for Transport, introducing what we've called a transport decarbonisation plan. That's been a very significant piece of work over the summer months. We will be publishing that plan actually before the end of the year, and that's where you will see a lot more specifics around how we intend to get there, what is the pathway, where are we going to change our policy in order to decarbonise various sectors. But I think, to your question, I think for me, one of the key focuses is obviously touching on the infrastructure piece that we've already mentioned. I think the whole area of freight is huge, and that's not just heavy freight, but it's also, you mentioned the last mile, it's the last mile deliveries, it's the smaller freight deliveries that are taking place now while people are working from home. I think we can actually really accelerate the work around this sort of zero emission automated logistics side of things. Data will be key for that. It's how do we gather the data, how do we use it really in a really smart way to figure out where our people actually, where the demand is, where the supply is, how we can bring that together and cut down on a lot of sort of unnecessary driving around, and also free up space on the streets for some of the, you know, the micromobility vehicles that we've potentially talked about.
I mean, there are the things that kind of happen behind the curtain, so to speak, and then the things that really are part of everybody's lives and really behavior change. So what do you think the main things that are going to need to be done in order to encourage behavior change? And I think the transport decarbonization plan is meant to be a part of that.
Behavior change is absolutely vital. And we know that government's got a really big job there in terms of giving people that confidence that there is going to be an electric vehicle charge point at their destination, for example. So, you know, we work hand in hand with the providers. But I think it also comes down to really simple things. Like, for example, if you know that it's going to be easy for you to put your bike on a train, or if you, you know, if it's really easy for you to actually charge your electric vehicle at home. So there's issues around for people who don't having to live, you know, someone with a drive. So we have to tackle those sorts of problems as well. We have to remove those barriers for people. But we do know that we're a social race, you know, not, sorry, we are social beings, aren't we? So we are very much influenced by what people around us are doing. So we believe, and the behavioural science that we've done actually bears this out, that the more that we see other people like us adopting zero emission forms of transport and enjoying it and seeing the benefits, the more that we will see that mass adoption. So it is very much about normalising it, removing the barriers, providing those incentives where they are appropriate and necessary, but just sending out the message that this is not a sort of hard thing to do. It's not an out there thing to do. It's a normal part of life that you need to drive an electric vehicle now, or a hydrogen cell vehicle, or whatever it will be in the future.
People are going to see us on their bikes and they're going to want to hop on a bike themselves. They'll be jealous of the bikes.
Exactly.
So on the transport decarbonization plan, you know, there were already several strategies in place, and you've gone through a bit on what the decarbonization plan looks to address. Are there any other things that it does that is, you know, really additional, and why it was so essentially needed in order to take it the next step?
Yeah, I mean, look, the department is already a leader in R&D and investment and working with the transport industry, but we had not specifically addressed the net zero by 2050 challenge, because the target was, I forget what it was, sorry, but it was lower than zero before we actually started this piece of work and before this particular government and parliament came into office. So we needed to look again at those challenges and see where there were still gaps that we needed to address in policy. I think the other point about it is that this is the first time that we've looked across the whole system. So we haven't just looked at buses as an individual mode of transport. We haven't just looked at shipping and maritime and aviation. We've looked all of it together, because there are obviously interconnectivities with how you decarbonize a particular area, for example. So we will not have the same solution for every part of the UK. It's really important that we think about local geographies, local issues. You know, what works in London is not going to work in my constituency in Redditch, for example, for all sorts of reasons. So it's very much about thinking about how do we make these things work on the ground in reality.
Well, here's to making things work on the ground in reality. Mr. McLean, thank you very much for joining us today and sharing us your insights and your strategies.
Thank you very much for having me.
Today's episode of Switched On was edited by Rex Warner of Greystoke Media.
Bloomberg NEF is a service provided by Bloomberg Finance LP and its affiliates. This recording does not constitute, nor should it be construed as, investment advice, investment recommendations, or a recommendation as to an investment or other strategy. Bloomberg NEF should not be considered as information sufficient upon which to base an investment decision. Neither Bloomberg Finance LP nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed.